service budget reform. Today is Monday, February 24th, and we are continuing with our informational meetings. And we have Ken Rutledge with us today, who is president of the Oregon Hospital Association, and he's going to talk about the economic and health care contributions of Oregon hospitals. Mr. Rutledge, sign in, please.
Thank you. I have I distributed some packets, and before I get started, let me tell you what you have in there. I'm told that you always like written testimony, so I actually have a narrative that begins, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Excuse me. Could you pull the microphones in? We have this room is really bad on acoustics.
Okay. Is that working better?
I think so. Is that better back there?
Okay. The second, right behind that in the folder, is a thing that says Oregon Hospital Utilization and Financial Indicators. What I did over the weekend was we have a system that is called Data Bank. Hospitals provide information on a monthly basis, and so we're current through the end of 2002. And what this does is basically do some comparisons of calendar year 2002 with calendar year 2001, and some of the results of this are incorporated into the testimony. The third sheet on the other side of the binder, it begins with this little piece, has a couple of things. One are some materials that we've used before that kind of describe what's going on with the hospital industry here. The one difference between this and the other numbers you see is that I did this about 6 months ago, and so when we look at the years here, we're talking about 12 months ending July or June 30th. So it's a little bit different than the numbers in that other sheet I gave you. The other materials in here all come from a study by the Lewin and Associates, which we will be releasing within the next day or two, and I think every member of the legislature will get a full copy of that report. So I've excerpted some of the materials out of there and put it in here. And the final piece, which is entitled Health Professional Shortages, there are two things in here. The first sheet basically shows you, as of September of last year, the number of vacant positions we have, various kinds of positions, to give you some sense of the demand for healthcare workers. The other are all from the Department of Oregon Employment Department, and basically it's part of the presentation I've made here. And what we look at is really healthcare and just how large a part of the Oregon economy that is. So those are the materials that are in the packet. And what I want to do is begin really by talking, just giving you a little bit of a sense of the healthcare side of hospitals in Oregon. If you look at 2002, we admitted over 346,000 patients and had over 1.5 million patient days. We had over 1 million emergency room visits and another 7 million outpatient visits, 322,000 surgeries, and brought over 46,000, or helped bring 46,000 babies into the world. So in terms of healthcare volume, what we're seeing is our volume continues to increase. In fact, on the utilization of financial indicators piece, I point out that overall our patient days are up just about 3% in 2002 over what they were the year before. One of the problems, however, we're having is that if you take a look at that utilization a little bit more closely, what you find is that Medicare, Medicaid, and self-pay, which is basically no insurance, they're all rising pretty significantly. But if you look at the commercial insurance, you see that's actually down 4.4% in 2002 over 2001. And so one of the things that hospitals are experiencing is really what we call a change in payer mix. And if you look at those payers, commercial is the best payer. Medicare probably comes next, Medicaid third, and self-pay, that's one of those areas where a lot of our bad debts come from. because frequently these are people who either don't have the ability to pay or we just can't collect from them.
That's functionally no insurance.
That's right. Right. And that's a group that's growing and growing. So, and I think what we're seeing here is the impact of the recession. As people are losing their jobs and losing their health coverage, the amount of our commercial business, which is the way we make our bottom line, is beginning to decline. And the government payers and the people without insurance are becoming a larger part of our utilization. But before we get into those problems, there's some things that I think you need to be aware of, because part of the direction that I think the legislature and the governor want to go is to try and do something to get our economy moving again, because until the economy gets moving, we're clearly not going to be able to deal with the budget shortfalls we're having. If you look at health care in general in Oregon, it's over a $12 billion industry. And if you look at our hospitals, we employ over 40,000 people. We have an annual payroll of $1.8 billion. And if you look at the people who work for us, pretty decent salaries. The average salary across the board was $48,775, with another almost $14,000 in benefits provided. You put on top of those 40,000 people economic multiplier that's actually we got from the state, and we're looking at a whole lot of other jobs that are created simply because of the purchasing power of the people that we employ and also the goods and services we buy in the community. That's another 24,000 people through the multiplier whose jobs are sustained because of health care. Now, one of the things we hear a lot of times is people saying, yes, you know, but unlike manufacturing, you're basically taking money from the state and providing a service, and so it's not like importing goods that we make here in Oregon. And I think one of the things that needs to be pointed out is that if you look at our hospitals, just looking at the percentage of their revenues that come from the federal government, it's 37%. So what we're really doing is importing that federal money in here and then providing not only health services but also jobs. When you look at rural areas, the amount of federal money rises to 41%, so in the rural areas it's even more significant. That's obviously because we have a higher Medicare population there. So I think there's clearly that kind of an economic impact. And so when you're talking about trying to restart the economy, or if you're talking about trying to get jobs, keep in mind that health care is the state's largest employer with over 108,000 people. Healthcare has the largest payroll of any industrial sector in the state. That's all shown in those charts that I provided to you. And unlike most of the other industries where what we're trying to do is create jobs, our problem isn't to create jobs. Our problem is to fill the jobs that we already have. That's one of the reasons that I provided you with the information that shows the number of vacancies we have, the average salaries. And so that's a frustration that we have, is that we've got positions, but we don't have people to fill them. And so when you take a look at it, part of what we're trying to do is create jobs, and I think there's a connection there with continuing to invest in health care.
Ken? Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Would you say, I mean, healthcare is the largest industry in Oregon. Is it the largest in California? I mean, is this fairly endemic nationwide that healthcare?
I think it's probably. In California, it wouldn't surprise me if it is, because when we look around Oregon, and you see this in some of the charts, in most communities. Healthcare is the largest employer in terms of numbers of people and also in terms of payroll. But certain communities, if you go down to Roseburg, Timber Products continues to be the largest employer there, and it also tends to be the largest payroll. I think the same thing can be said in Coos Bay as an example. Across the state and in many communities, we're the largest employer. In California, which has a large aerospace, a large high-tech industry, may be tough to say, but I would say that if they're not the largest employer in California, then they're probably the second largest.
Well, one would assume, Mr. Chair, that if health care is 70% of GDP, that there's probably no other single industry that can measure up to that nationwide. So,
Probably the case. Now, what I've talked about is lots of job opportunities, talked about good salaries, and I've talked about the fact that although we're not too happy with the change in our payer mix, that the demand for health care continues to grow in Oregon. Surgeries are up, babies up, all that sort of thing. But I think one of the things that you need to know is that we're not recession-proof. And one of the things that we're discovering of late is that we're seeing some fairly significant declines in the financial conditions of hospitals. Now, obviously, this varies from community to community and from hospital to hospital, but nevertheless, there are some numbers that I wanted to share with you. I already talked about how the payer mix is starting to go away. If we look at our bad debts and our charity care, which to a large degree are a reflection of the growing numbers of uninsured, in 2002, bad debts were up 17% over the previous year. Charity care was up 38.5% over the previous year. It topped out at $107 million, almost $108 million. If we look at hospital margins, once again comparing the two calendar years, statewide operating margins fell from 5.3% in 2001 to 4.5% in 2002. Average total margins fell from 6.3% to 4.8%. Now, if you look at that, it's a little bit sobering, but it's not anything to be terribly frightened of if you look at margins in the neighborhood of almost 5%. But one of the things I did, because of the reports that we've got in from our hospitals, is I wanted to take a little bit closer look at what's happened as we've gone further into the recession. And so I took a look and I made a comparison of the last quarter of 2002, and I compare that with the last quarter of 2001. A lot of my hospitals have indicated that their margins began to really slip at the end of 2002. And in the testimony here, I've told you what happened. Our inpatient utilization was up 1.6%, a little less growth than the 2.9 we saw for the entire year. But our commercially insured patients' utilization was down 6.3% compared with the 4.4% we saw for the whole year. Bad debts went up 18.2% compared with 17% for the whole year. Charity care rose 55% in comparing the last quarter of 2002 with the last quarter of 2001. And then when we take a look at margins, patient service margin, that's basically how well do we cover our costs simply with patient revenue. In the last quarter of 2001, we had a patient service margin of 0.3%, which is about what we expect. We expect to pretty much break even on patient care, or a little less than breaking even. Last quarter of 2002,
Rick.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Brooks, do you know roughly how that kind of compares across the nation, some of those same figures? Is Oregon standing out one way or another from the rest of the country in some of these? Do you have a sense of that?
I think to a put it this way, historically, Oregon has probably done better on its operating margins than a lot of other states. And that's because when you look at who the big payers are. Medicaid is important, and our Medicaid program here pays very poorly, but Medicare is a much bigger program. And Oregon has done well on Medicare simply because we put fewer people in the hospital and we keep them for a shorter period of time. And so when you look at our costs as compared with what we're actually paid, we've tended to do better. The other thing that I've seen in comparing us with other states is that, and I think it's a reflection of our insurance market here, we seem to do a better job or more successful in cost shifting. We don't have the big national insurance firms here in Oregon for the most part. You know, we've got Blue Cross, we've got Providence. They're, for the most part, it's dominated by not-for-profits. We have, with the exception of Portland, most communities, the hospital is the only It's the only hospital there. And so from a just a negotiation perspective, it's put them in a stronger position. That's how it's been historically. However, if you take a look at how we're paid under our Medicaid program, Oregon has one of the worst paying Medicaid programs in the country. And if you take a look at our recession, as I think we all know, is one of the worst in the country. And so I think that what I would say is that we've gone from probably being better than most of the nation to being worse off than a lot of places that we were better than before.
Representative Greenland.
Ken, I'm following along. You're talking both in the written testimony
right.
And the other page. It looks like even though the charity care was up 38% to $100 million roughly, and the bad debts up 17% to $158 million, your total payer payments were still 109% of the actual cost, which I think in this case included both the charitable care, the bad debts, and the margin?
The patient service margin.
Not the patient service, the total margin. I was looking at this document you have. Same numbers.
Which page is that?
It's on the
Oh, you're looking
page.
At that sheet.
Well, I was just following your numbers that
oh, okay.
you were reading.
You're
You've got
that.
Them in both
Going
places.
On. Okay, in terms of the,
so it's the
patient,
total
patient revenue margin, we showed 0.6%.
No, and I was looking at, it's under payer performance.
Right.
It says total payer payments were 100.9% of the actual costs.
Right.
And that included both your the margin of $230 million
right.
or so.
So basically,
plus
basically
the charitable
they
care
were doing,
plus
they were doing, as I said, typically it's about break even. It was 1.9%. And I think part of this is if you take a look.
Well, 6.3% was the total margin.
Total margin. In 2002.
And your numbers?
Percentage margin. Total margin 4.8% in 2002, down from 6.3% in 2001.
4.8%. Yeah, so, I mean, you were paid all the margin plus all the bad debts plus all the charitable care and about broke even with all those things
right.
with the margin.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. And the point I was making here is that in the last quarter, here's what happened. First of all, we went to a loss of 2.6% on patient revenue for the last quarter. Second thing is that operating margins fell from 4.3% to 1.5%, and total margins from 5.8% to 0.3%, or 0.3%. That's for the last quarter. So what I'm pointing out is that the recession, I think, is clearly beginning to have an impact. And the reasons are, once again, larger number of uninsured. Frequently we're in the middle of contract years, and so there hasn't been an opportunity to try and extract that money from the private sector. And we're working with a smaller base now because of more people being uninsured. And the point I'm trying to make is that this whole issue of you know, hospitals haven't been affected by the recession. I think that early on that was relatively true. But I think that it's clear from those numbers where basically you've gone from the 4.3% margin in the last quarter of 1 year down to 1.5%, that something's happening, which is basically that either the revenues aren't keeping up with the costs or the costs are exceeding the revenues.
Or that fourth quarters are weird, which is sometimes.
Well, but you're comparing fourth quarter to fourth quarter.
Yeah, but it's
I mean, you're comparing the same period of time. So in terms of utilization variations from 1 year to the next, I mean, we can take as an example Legacy Emanuel Hospital and the entire Legacy system. Now, most people, when they think of Legacy, thinking, you know, they want to build a place in Clark County, they've got to be doing okay. But the payer mix, the Medicaid load at Legacy Emanuel has gone up so significantly, and that hospital is losing a lot of money. And as a result, for the last quarter of 2002, the entire Legacy system had a negative operating margin. They lost money. You know, the numbers are what they are, and if we track it, I think there's some things that are fairly clear. The number of people who have commercial insurance that we serve is going down. The number of uninsured is going up. The charity care, the last quarter of the charity care went up 50% over the previous year. So the point I'm making is that we are beginning to feel some financial distress. Now, and when you're faced with that situation, and keep in mind that we haven't even gotten into the point now where we're looking at redoing the Oregon Health Plan and potentially either making significant across-the-board cuts, as are being proposed by the Department of Human Services, or eliminating categories of people who are covered by the program, those things have not yet come into play. And still the financial condition has deteriorated to this extent. And when that happens, you only have a certain number of choices. You can dig into your reserves and say we're gonna operate a loss and we're gonna keep it up and begin to draw down our reserves. You can try and shift the losses to commercial payers. If you take a look at what commercial payers pay us right now, it's about almost 120% of the actual cost. So we have been successful to some degree in shifting underpayment by Medicare and Medicaid and charity care and bad debt over to the private sector. But we're seeing what the ramifications of that are. If we take a look at the situation with the schools in Portland, where the thing that is stopping this from a decision from being made is the health care benefits and the unwillingness of the teachers to have those health care benefits capped. And so there's a point at which this cost shifting begins to have an additional drag on the economy of Oregon, either in terms of raising business costs or in terms of people losing their insurance, either because they're unwilling to pay a higher premium or because the businesses are unwilling to provide the insurance anymore. We're able to take a look at health services and eliminate some of the more unprofitable ones, and this is happening. We've sent out surveyed our members to get some sense of what kind of actions they've either taken or plan on taking. The areas that you see mentioned most often tend to be in the area of such things as support for school health clinics, other kinds of community outreach kinds of programs. When we've taken a look at actual services, we've had a number of them indicate that their home health care agency, their nursing homes, and their hospice care programs are areas that they're going to have to look at. And when it comes to actual clinical services, one of the things that's difficult with getting answers from the hospitals is that they have a concern about either frightening their employees in terms of talking about layoffs and what that's going to do to employee morale, or actually saying we're going to have to get rid of these services before they know they actually have to do it and looking at what the impact is on the community. But among the things that I've been told in the response to this is in one community, and all the ones I'm going to talk about are where there's only one hospital, we're talking about eliminating an outpatient chemotherapy program, which means that people who need that chemotherapy are going to have to go to another community. Down south, I'll mention Klamath Falls. When I talked with the CEO down there, I was at an editorial board meeting, and I asked him, what have you considered in the way of services? And at first he didn't want to go into it, but he finally said, we're taking a look at our renal dialysis program, which loses money. The problem is that if we cut that program out, then people are going to have a 3-hour round trip, either up to Bend or over to Medford to get their dialysis, and that's about three or four times a week that they have to do that. We've taken a look at cardiac Roseburg, both a cardiac rehab program, looking at closing that. So the fact is that the financial problems that a lot of hospitals, not all, but in the aggregate and in many specific instances are having is beginning to show in terms of actually eliminating services in the community, looking at clinical programs that don't make their way and getting rid of those. They have a double impact. People who run those programs are going to lose jobs, and the people in those communities are no longer going to have that service. And, of course, the other thing is just the community support that I think we're going to see going away. When we take a look at what the challenge that you're faced with, it's a tough one. But I think one of the things that I need to say today is that if there's an impression or an illusion that the hospitals in this state are strong enough and financially sound enough to be able to, in effect, help to increase their subsidization of the Oregon Health Plan, I think you're wrong. We have hospitals that do well financially, but for the most part, that has to do with the fact that they're either located in a community or a neighborhood where there's not a lot of Medicaid, and it's not a really depressed community relative to others. And I think that if you're looking at this from the healthcare impact, and if you're taking a look at, for not just Medicaid beneficiaries, but for all people in Oregon, and if you're looking at it from the economic impact, I think you have to look very closely at making decisions that are going to directly force us to increase the subsidization that we're already having to do with the Oregon Health Plan. The Lewin study, I think you'll see when we come out with that, is going to show that the underpayment of hospitals in Oregon is very significant, and it's grown over time primarily through an erosion of payment rather than any cuts. We're now talking about cuts, and from our perspective, we're going to continue to serve these people, but our ability to serve the entire community is going to be impacted if there's a request for us to try and do more in the way of keeping in place programs for which there's not otherwise money.
Yeah, Ken, I'm looking at these figures and I'm trying to figure out at 100.9% of actual cost how you could do any capital improvements at all. But because you have to have a profit to expand, we know that. But beyond that, what is the 12% proposed hit in DRG going to do to this number?
Well, let me make one point, and that is in terms of I've been tracking hospital operating and patient service margins for over 20 years, and typically what you'll find is that patient service margins are going to be pretty close to break even. That's I think really where we target, because our bottom line comes from other operating revenue, non-direct patient service revenue. That's where the operating margin comes from, and then of course investment income is what gives us our total margin. That's how we can still do capital projects, because we don't have to live on that 0.9% normally. Normally what we'll have is 3 or 4% simply because of other operating revenue. In terms of the 12% cuts, we've shown you the breakdown of how that would impact hospitals, and clearly the more you're a regional referral center and the more you serve Medicaid beneficiaries, the bigger the impact is going to be. And what we're talking about is not only a 12% across the board cut in our DRG payments, which according to the Lewin study average about 69% of cost right now. We're also talking about a 12% across the board cut in outpatient payments, which by the payment formula used by OMAP are based on 59% of cost. So we're talking about reducing that another 12%. In addition, we're talking about eliminating most of the outlier payments. Those are the payments that pay 25% of extraordinary costs for special high-cost patients. Lewin says this is going to have about a $25 million. Those cuts will have about a $20 million, I think, a little less than $20 million a year impact, at least based on the percentage of our business that is done on a fee-for-service basis now. What's not indicated is, number one, we're seeing more of a shift away from the managed care Medicaid to fee-for-service. The second is that many of the managed care contracts that we have for Medicaid are pegged to the Medicaid fee-for-service. And so there's going to be, I think, a very significant impact. Here's what I say about the cuts. Number one, if they occur, and also remember we're talking about eliminating retroactive eligibility, which means that, and by the way, one of the points I make in here is that if you look at our admissions to our hospitals, 48% of those admissions come through the emergency room. Right? So 48% of our admissions are generated through the emergency room. And when you talk about retroactive eligibility, you're talking about people who enter the healthcare delivery system through the emergency room. And in effect, what that's going to mean is that those people who are eligible for the Medicaid program but not enrolled, the doctors and the hospitals that provide care to them for roughly the first 2 months, which is when they're going to be getting 95% of their care, we won't get payment for that because payment won't begin until after the application's been processed, a determination made, and we reach the first of the next month. I would say that you're going to have some hospitals who are going to be very financially distressed, and the kinds of actions that I've talked about, they're going to have to do in a more severe way. Since it appears that right now OMAP's not willing to challenge the legislation that protects A's and B's, I won't say anything about the impact on them except through the presumptive eligibility or retroactive eligibility. But that's a lot, you know, I've shown you, we've already lost a significant amount of our operating margins. We're going to have to do significant cutbacks, and so the impact is going to be this. To the degree that we can't find ways of cutting our costs, to the degrees that we can't pass this on to the private sector in the form of higher hospital charges, and to the degree that we can't live off of the reserves that we have, then I think you may see a few hospitals that get really financially distressed. Whether they're going to close or not, that's hard. It's hard for me to say. But one of the things that we'll do in those communities is you're going to see people laid off. You're going to see a growing number of uninsured. And in terms of trying to get our economy moving, it's going to be doing just the opposite of what we want to do. The other thing I'll say is that with respect to the cuts that are proposed to go in on March 1st, it's our position that we do not plan to sit back and passively accept those. So there will be legal action if those cuts go into effect on the 1st. It's one thing when the legislature has had an opportunity to review and to make decisions among a host of alternatives. It's another thing when an agency has ignored the fact that each one of these proposals has been rejected every time it's been taken to the legislature and determines that they'll use their own administrative authority to go forward with them.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Ken. I had OMAP in this morning to explain themselves, and it does appear that they plan on implementing. So call your lawyer. You probably already have.
We have.
Ken, help me. I'm on page 2 here again.
Okay.
Your investment income, is it fair to assume then that your margin, this 0.9%, to get then your investment, the percent of your investment income, would you take that 0.9 away from the 4.8, and therefore you're getting 3.9% investment income?
The investment income is the difference between the 4.5% operating margin and the 4.8. In other words, the difference between our operating margin and our total margin is, for the most part, investment income.
So that'd be 0.3%.
Right, right.
Round numbers. How many hospitals are there in Oregon?
there are a total of 60 hospitals, acute care hospitals.
60, and of those, even down to this, you know, 0.9% actual, would payers actually covering the cost, how many of those 60 would actually be having their costs covered?
You know, that's one where I'd have to go back to my office, go into the computer and run a profile on each one of them. It's something I can do. It's not something that I did here.
That's not a critical question, but it's fair to say that of the 60, some are losing money.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, when you look at the patient service margin, I would say that, you know, probably 3/4 of them lose money on that. When you look at their operating margin or their total margin, in other words, are they losing money once you throw in investment income and non-operating or other forms of operating revenue? I'm trying to remember. It seems to me that when you look at the A's and B's, the last time I looked, 13 out of the 32 were losing money, and I would probably say there are another 10 hospitals among those 29 so-called DRG hospitals that actually lost money. And I'm talking now about the calendar year 2002. If I look at the last quarter, I think that number is significantly higher.
This document says that only 7 of Oregon's 31 small hospitals would be breaking even based on the projected
cuts. And here's one thing. Here's also something to consider with the Lewin study. You know, Lewin used both OMAP data and other published data, and their analysis is pretty much through 2001. Because we have access to data through all of 2002, my numbers are a better reflection of what's happened once we got into the recession. But obviously, they couldn't use that data as it came in on a monthly basis. But yeah, that's a reflection of what their projections are if the A and B cuts went into place. But also keep in mind that as they look at the impact of these cuts, that they're working off the base that they saw in 2001, which was significantly better than it was in 2002.
It's probably optimistic that 7 broke even out of the 31.
Well, that's, Mr. Chair, that's based on the projected cuts to A and B that will not happen.
That won't happen, right. Unless
I have a coup in my committee, they will not happen.
Yeah, as I said, last time I looked, 13 of the A's and B's were losing money. And I can kind of go through my head and picture the others that lost money in 2002. For the most part, hospitals would like to have, when you look at the, here are the things I got to do. First of all, we're dealing with a workforce shortage. And so our particularly our nursing salaries are going up significantly, 7-8%. There aren't enough nurses, so we're paying registries at significantly higher rates. So our payroll expenses are very high. Because we have to provide health care insurance to our employees, our benefits are going up, so those are very high. And then across the board, the bad debts and the charity care. And then on top of that, I mean, I think everybody knows the cost of pharmaceuticals and all of the things that are happening with technological improvements in the resources we buy. You're aware of what's happening with malpractice. I've had hospitals that had 100% increases in their malpractice premiums. And so we've got all these escalating costs. There's also the demand that you've got to be able to deal with the new technology that's got to be incorporated. You know, people talk about the building programs that our hospitals are always doing, but the fact of the matter is that the way in which we provide care is changing, and the technology is changing. And once a particular kind of technology gets accepted, you almost have a responsibility to incorporate that, or you're not providing the standard of care that the community is supposed to have. Hospitals in the urban areas would like to see a 5-6% operating margin in order to be able to do all of the improvements and to cover the various, the capital improvements and the development and the growth that they're going to need. So to the degree that they're below that, you know, they have to make some choices about what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. When you get margins that go down to the point where they're disappearing, then it's not a matter of what kinds of capital improvements you're going to make. It's what kind of services you're going to be able to continue to subsidize, because a lot of the services that hospitals provide don't cover their costs. I mean, we not only shift between payers, we shift between services. And when you get to the point where you're looking at being able to keep the hospital operating, pay your employees, and not destroy your reserves, then you've got to start looking at what services are just losing us too much money and do we have to get rid of. And I think that's where a lot of the hospitals are. We still have some who are doing well, but the more Medicaid you have, the poorer community you're in, and to some degree, the common equation is the less commercial business you have, the worse off you're going to be. And so many of our hospitals are the sole hospital in the community that they've got a mix of all of that in one. In some of the large urban areas like Portland, you can be in a community where more people who are employed, more people with health insurance, and so you're going to see a more solid bottom line. But they're getting fewer and fewer of those.
Thank you, Chair. And perhaps you're going to get to this. In an earlier discussion somewhere in committee, there was a talk about the charitable care that hospitals are required to provide under federal law. Are you going to go into that? Could you explain a little bit what
that entails
and what you must provide?
I think there are two things that come into play here. What a lot of people are thinking about in terms of hospitals' charity requirements is what's called the Hill-Burton Act. That was after World War II, a lot of hospitals in this country were built with what was called Hill-Burton. That was the name of the legislative sponsor's money. And with that, you accepted a certain charity care responsibility. So far as I know, most of our hospitals in this state have gone beyond whatever the time frames were on most of those requirements. And so if you look at the whole charity care and accepting people regardless of ability to pay, that's more mission-driven than it is a government mandate. On the other hand, where we do have a mandate is under federal requirements that say that anyone who arrives in a hospital emergency room, they must be screened, they must be assessed, and they must be treated for whatever the condition is that they've arrived with to stabilize them. So that's where the requirement is in terms of us not being able to turn anyone away. On the other hand, if you take a look at... Medicaid, could a hospital, as physicians sometimes do, or pharmacies have said they might do, refuse to participate in the Medicaid program? And what forces you to participate in it? I think it's your sense of the role that you play in the community and how the community would perceive you. There's nothing that requires a hospital to participate in that program. There's nothing that requires a hospital to take on elective procedures people without the resources to pay. But it's part of the not-for-profit pact, I guess, that hospitals have with their communities, and a lot of it's mission-driven. So since so many of them are based on have religious origins.
But are any of these 60? I mean, you only have to do that if you accept federal dollars for Medicaid, Medicare.
I'm sorry?
You only have to do that. Accept those patients if you
accept federal dollars in the form of Medicaid, Medicare? Bruce is shaking his head no.
Help me on this one with the emergency room. Right, regardless. Yeah, that's what I thought. In terms of emergency room, That's a requirement regardless of where the who's covering the patient. When someone presents in an emergency room, they have to be treated.
Stabilized.
They have to be, I think the words are evaluated, treated, and stabilized. And it came out of some history back in the maybe the 70s and 80s where, not in this state but in other states, there was a sense that certain hospitals were dumping patients on other hospitals. In other words, they'd come to the emergency room, so they'd shift them someplace else, and that was the concept behind this. Is it, someone comes to the emergency room in an emergency, you've got to deal with that emergency.
Representative Greenland.
You can't dial 911 and send them off to the next place, huh?
Unless they're on divert.
Isn't there some, the extent to which Oregon hospitals are non-profit under federal income tax, section 501c3, there is some requirement, although it's not very specific, to do education, research, and charitable care. You mentioned sort of general social compact, but you don't sense that there's some...
I might turn to the attorney again there. I don't know under the federal tax exemption, Bruce, that there are some guidelines, but I don't think they are specific in terms of providing care to all regardless of ability to pay.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's right. But there is some obligation.
Yes. Well, it's a little bit like recently the tax exempt status a number of years ago were challenged at a number of the hospitals in the Portland area, and in effect what there wasn't any specific here's how you meet the exemption criteria. What the hospitals did was present in some detail all of the charitable care and other community services they provided. And then it was up to Multnomah County to make a determination about whether or not that met their understanding of the tax exempt requirements.
That was on property tax exemption.
Right.
You have a follow-up to that, Nick?
No, I mean, I think that's right. There was a sense that hospitals needed to spend 5% of their total expenditure on education, research, and charitable care, which is about what you have here between bad debts. But that was never codified in a specific amount in terms of the federal tax exemption, but there is a requirement that the nonprofit hospitals at least engage in charitable care as a part of that community service model.
Right.
Follow up?
Thank you. State that again then. The charitable care is actually a tax exemption for hospitals? Is that what I heard you just say? I know it's a write-off, but... Do you actually...
You're asking me. What I said was in order to maintain the federal income tax exemption for hospitals under 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, there's an obligation to do community services, education, research, and charitable care. But it's never been exactly quantified in terms of what meets that test.
Yeah, I think that's pretty evident. I mean, if you take a look at, as I said, I have access to all of the hospital numbers, and you'll see some fairly significant variations between the amount of charity care or other community services provided. Now, part of that may be as a result of how the board prioritizes things, and part of it may also, if you're, I'm not going to mention specific numbers, but as an example, a place like Meridian Park, which is a suburban hospital, isn't going to have the same demands placed upon it for either charity care or experience the same kind of levels of bad debt as a place like Legacy Emmanuel. But there aren't any specific numbers that need to be there. What's interesting was, when the Oregon Health Plan first went into effect, it worked. Charity care fell pretty significantly. In Oregon, it went down about 30%, and our bad debts also declined, and even emergency room use declined, and that went on for about 3 or 4 years, and then charity care started climbing. It's now up beyond what it was when the Oregon Health Plan went into effect. But I mean, clearly, the idea that by providing adequate coverage to of people who didn't have insurance was going to have an impact on not only charity care and emergency room use, but also on stabilizing premiums in the private sector, it really did work. Unfortunately, as those payments began to erode more and more and more over time, it reversed itself.
Ken, could you maybe, that would be very interesting to look at the sort of the history of that in terms of the raw numbers of charity cases and emergency use, et cetera, tied to, you know, sort of with the timeline of the health plan, and what percentage of the visits that represented too. I think, I mean, if we would expect that as population increases, you'd have more in number, but.
Yeah, I'd be happy, and actually I can, you're going to be hearing the rural health care tomorrow. I'll make sure that we have that information for you. It takes 10 minutes to produce it.
Great. Great. Representative Cruz, you look like you're about ready to ask a question.
No, I'm actually fine at the moment, I think.
Okay. Continue.
Well, I think that pretty well covers what I wanted to go over. I think, you know, there's some good charts in here that you should just be aware of. I talked about how we did relatively well under the Medicare program historically. And on this thing with a whole bunch of little charts, you'll see one of the reasons is our expenses per admission tend to be fairly low as compared with other states, and our use of hospital services is also fairly low as compared with other states. So in effect, the hospitals in Oregon are very competitive, and I won't just say the hospitals, because obviously it's physicians who make determinations about when people are put in hospitals and how long they're there. We have a reputation for being among the best when it comes to end-of-care life by having fewer people spending times in critical care units or even being hospitalized. I've got a little bit of a chart on the charity care on the next page. Once again, these are numbers that are through July of each year, not through December as the other ones are. And you can see the growth that's occurred there. You can also see what's happening with our emergency room visits. That's clearly a growing problem. And I know, in fact, there's some people who are looking at our whole trauma system and how that's being overstressed. And one of the reasons is we're dealing not only with trauma, but also primary care visits, because it's the only way that a lot of people can access health care services. And then I think that this whole idea of the cost shift, if you look at talking a little bit about trends, if you look at what's happened with private insurance, where we've gone from 110% of cost to almost 120% of cost, and you track that with the declines in Medicare and Medicaid, I think you can see, and then add to that the charity and bad debt, you can understand not only the upward pressure, but you can also see that our strategy of passing these costs on to the private sector has been successful. Given the state of our economy right now, I think that's going to be increasingly difficult to do, because we're working with a smaller and smaller base of people who are insured. I talked about the fact that while we're facing cuts on March 1st, I talked about the erosion of the payment system in Oregon, and this chart that says updates to Medicaid inpatient operating payment rates, I think you can see our cost of goods has gone up 33% since the Oregon Health Plan went into effect, while the actual updates under fee-for-service have only gone up about 12.7%. That's part of that problem that we're seeing. The other thing, when you take a look at, you know, why is our Oregon Health Plan, we hear about it's bloated and so on and so forth. But if you look at Oregon, and I only have one of the charts here, the expenditures per beneficiary that we make in Oregon are actually fairly low. The other thing is that with respect to Medicare, they pay us significantly better. But from this chart, you can see that the Medicare expenditures in Oregon are also low. The difference is there's they're corresponding with our costs, which are also low. In the case of Medicaid, that doesn't happen. The other pieces in here, I wanted you to take a look at how the fee-for-service methodology works. And under this thing called Exhibit 7, as you can see, on average, hospitals are paid 72% of their cost, not the A's and B's, 72% of their cost under the inpatient, 59% of their cost under the outpatient, and 69% overall. The next chart shows what the Lewin people said would be the impact of the cuts. I also want to point out that with the Medicaid program, whether we're talking about eliminating people or services, or if you're talking about cutting reimbursement, it has a disproportionate impact. And so what I've included in here is another chart that shows who the high Medicaid hospitals are in Oregon. These are all hospitals that are over the average, and as you can see, it goes from, you know, Silverton to, we think, a fairly wealthy community, Ashland, but still they've got 20% of their people. It's pretty much all around the state, and of course the larger the numbers are, the larger the total dollars, but when you look at the payer mix, it tells you how much. And here in Salem, because we have a population that's for the most part well insured, not a huge impact. If you go down to over on the east side, if you go to Mountain View, you can see there's a huge impact. If we go down to Klamath Falls, same thing there. Corvallis area out in eastern Oregon, Mercy and Roseburg and so on. So I think that when you look at the decisions that are going to be made and look at how they'll impact hospitals and communities disproportionately, you should take a look at this list, because this is where the biggest hits are going to be felt. The final piece that's in here is an excerpt from that study, and it basically talks about the impact of below-cost payment on access to care. These people have experience in looking at this. And by the way, the Lewin, if you're not familiar with Lewin, while they did our study, they also, interestingly enough, in Washington, did one for the state Medicaid agency up there. So they work both sides of the street and have a lot of expertise in this. And one of the reasons we chose them is because they've done these kinds of studies in a lot of other states, and we're able to really take a look at how we compare. And one of the things they conclude is that we do compare very poorly here in Oregon in terms of how the Medicaid program pays. And in fact, one of the things they say is that, unfortunately, one of the ways in which we've expanded the populations covered in the Medicaid program is by consciously shifting that cost to the providers, realizing that in effect then that the general population is going to end up paying for it in the long run.
Now,
and I've run out of things to say unless you have questions.
I've got a question. If we go back to the first page of the thing you just went through, Ken, and I mean, part of the fact that hospital stays in Oregon are less is because we've got maybe a better network than some places, and they do, when they get past the acute level, they go to nursing home or wherever like that.
You're right. Although the feds, you know, the federal government has a policy of letting no good deed go unpunished.
And so their rates are lower there.
And one of the things that we've been punished by lower rates, but the other thing that's happened is that you're right. The reason that we spend less on end-of-life care, the reason that we have overall fewer admissions, fewer patient days, is that we've had a good network of not only nursing homes but alternatives to institutionalized nursing homes. We've had a good system of health, of home health care agencies, and unfortunately one of the things that the federal government did when they passed the Balanced Budget Act in 1997 was they put in place a whole lot of disincentives, particularly on home health care. And so we continue to be better nationally in terms of our use of resources, but there are barriers that the federal government, you know, sort of unintended consequences that have ended up making it more difficult to do here. But you're right, it's that whole network of providers and the fact that our by tradition and by culture, there has been a willingness to look for things other than inpatient hospitalization as a setting to provide care. And that's why the increased use of the emergency room as a primary care clinic is pretty tragic, because that's a very expensive place for people to be going.
I guess, Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to see in both nursing homes and home health. I know some home health organizations and some nursing homes are owned by hospitals, but and some aren't. It would be interesting to kind of see that matrix, what the mix is.
Well, I know that, you know, home health care agencies and nursing homes can't be doing well, because when I got the results back from our members about the services that they were looking at closing their home health care agencies and closing their nursing homes were frequently listed as areas in which they would reduce their exposure to operations that lost money.
Well, and I'm well aware of that, and that's kind of the point I'm getting to is, I mean, hospitals deliver a lot of services outside of just hospitalization. Some are profitable and some are not, and we're talking about in home health and nursing homes kind of a key piece of the puzzle that because of federal reimbursement and other reasons are... I mean, there's fear that we lose them, and that's a significant piece of comprehensive health care. So.
And the thing that I want to keep coming back to is we're not talking about this impacting just Medicaid beneficiaries.
Right.
Because, the cutting back on these services or limiting these services means that they're not available for all of the other people in the community.
Yeah, but if you're in a community like Roseburg that over 20% of the clients are Medicaid eligible... if the impact is this level on hospitals and then you go to home health or nursing homes with even worse reimbursement rates, it's got to be compounded. So,
just an editorialization, Chair.
Can't you have a chart like this for Medicaid?
Yes, I do. And in putting my materials together this morning, I thought that's what I had told them to put in there.
Well, this one's interesting, too.
Yeah, I mean, it just helps highlight the big picture.
Yeah, no, I do have that chart. My recollection from it, and as I had already indicated, there were a couple of things that some people made some requests about being able to produce, in terms of tracking both emergency, I think it was emergency room, and charity care and the bad debt over the length of the Oregon Health Plan. I'm going to also make sure that when you meet tomorrow that you have the relevant Medicaid charts for that as well.
And you're joining us again tomorrow?
That's my understanding.
Very good. Yeah, because, I mean, this is 42% of your payer mix. And that doesn't look pretty. And then the next biggest component is Medicaid, and I don't think
it looks worse.
That will even look as pretty as this.
Yeah. My recollection was that we're ninth lowest on that, but I'll bring the chart.
We're shooting for number one now.
Well, as of March 1, if we're not successful in stopping those cuts, we will be number one.
Yeah.
I understand.
I'm sorry, maybe Tennessee is worse.
You think?
Maybe Tennessee.
And we're 14th worst here.
Yeah.
Round numbers, quick count.
You know, I'm no longer lusting after Florida. I would even go for Oklahoma. In our
ranks. Well, obviously Paul Risser did, so I mean...
But, I mean, you know, those are about 5,500, it looks like, as compared to our 43.
I just find it interesting that Washington, D.C. is the highest. Yeah. I wonder how that happened.
It's they're highest in everything. In fact, a lot of times I do these comparisons of states, and I take them off because they ruin the graph. And here's what I think it is. It's because you have a lot of hospitals in D.C., and I think that they serve a larger population area. So you've got those people coming in, and it builds up the per capita thing. You know, one of the things you have to be aware of, and it's true with Medicaid and it's true with Medicare. I mean, I've had these questions about MUPL lately. And most states, including with Medicare and Medicaid, there are a whole host of different ways of getting federal money earmarked for something that brings it into your state. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, that D.C. maybe has that. Maybe it's because that's where our members of Congress and the president get their care, so they want to make sure there's plenty of money.
But the president went to Bethesda.
That's right, in Maryland.
Okay.
Where's Maryland?
Any other questions for Mr.?
It is interesting. They may get a lot of Northern Virginia and stuff like that coming in there. So that's pretty much bedroom communities.
Is there anything else the committee would like to see Ken bring us tomorrow that we haven't alluded to already? What kind of pizza?
Pepperoni.
Pepperoni pizza, okay.
Just a joke.
I hope this was what you had in mind. I wasn't really certain, but I thought an overall view of keep in mind that, you know, there's that healthcare side, but don't forget the economic side, because in a lot of your communities, that's the biggest employer.
Well, I guess my question is, I mean, you've outlined pretty well the plight of the hospitals. I understand that. The question is, Ken, you got any ideas?
Well, I think, as you know, we've been participating in those evening meetings, and I think what we're trying to do is produce some ideas there, without a doubt. I mean, the point is, what I'm concerned about is, you know, I don't want to see any communities lose their hospitals. There have been 12 hospitals that have closed since I came here, and in some instances they were in small rural communities. Others, they were voluntarily in Portland before the world changed. But here's the concern that I've got. We're going to serve these people really regardless. I mean, you're not going to. I don't think you're going to see any hospitals saying, "That's it. We're not going to take any more people." But where my concern is about not only the fact that this can make the economic situation worse, because we're such major employers and provide such high salary jobs, the other is the potential impact it's going to have on eliminating services in certain communities and creating additional hardships. And I think that you know, the approach that we're taking is consistent with what the Oregon Health Plan says. I mean, if we were like some states, Missouri and Ohio, where hospitals are getting over 90% of their cost paid under the Medicaid program, it would be different. And all I'm saying here is, I mean, you're going to have to do what you're going to have to do. And we're trying to give you some ideas on how to go about living within that budget. But at the same time, part of what I want to say to the entire legislature is, think about the economics of this as well, and about those lost federal dollars. And then the second part of it is, let's try and do this in a way that has, I mean, we're going to hurt the Medicaid population, but part of what you may end up doing is not only hurt the Medicaid population, but every other person in the community, because we're going to find that services are no longer going to be available in that community. We're going to see a whole lot of the voluntary services. I'm not looking for it to get better for us. I mean, this is the consequence of the recession, and we're doing our part. What I'm looking for is the state to avoid kind of a death blow, by assuming that we're in a position to once again subsidize the state program to a greater degree than we're already doing.
Well, but Ken, it is going to get worse for you and everyone else if we don't make it better.
Right.
Because we're going to shift costs to the commercial plans. Fewer employers are going to be able to provide, you know, offer, make.
Yeah, it becomes a circle. Just a spiral. It's worse and worse.
So, I mean, this is like a submarine. You just don't stop. I mean, you just don't hover. You're either going forward or you're going down.
Well, I hope that the materials that, or the what we've been providing in the way of input in those evening meetings is, you know, something that I've been a part of of developing, and you know, from what I've seen so far, it looks like there's at least some productive results coming out of that kind of analysis that's being done, looking at what kind of a benefit package can we afford.
Well, film at 11, but we got some bad news for Kevin tonight and you. I mean, looks like we're down about $50 million off of the numbers we've been working on.
That's because of the updating of the moving it forward.
They didn't include the mandatory population of mental health for kids in the federal Medicaid package. So that dropped us from about 263 governor's balanced budget to about 227. And again, that's governor's balanced budget. So when you get there, you can almost buy back pharmaceuticals, which went up. And that's no incidence, no utilization, no intensity of care. I mean, that's none of the Price Waterhouse Coopers. We haven't bought back one dime in that. So the wheel didn't turn in the right direction over the weekend.
No, but the wheel did turn, and we do have to deal with the reality we have.
Right.
But we are incredibly aware of the hydraulics of what we do in one part of the system, and we're also aware that the biggest hit in the last year or so has been in the private sector. So.
Yep.
Okay, look forward to seeing you tomorrow with that pepperoni pizza.
Yeah, from New York. See, no other business come before the committee? We are adjourned.